The only advice that I would have is don't wait too long to get onto the trend. If it's happening, it's happening, and you should get on it. Otherwise, you're going to be left behind. But also don't wait too long to get off again. Nothing lasts forever.
From Bright Umbrella, this is Control ClickCast. We inspect the web for you. Today, we have Lori Voss on the show to talk about trends in web development. I'm your host, Leia Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
Today's episode is sponsored by Fostermade, a versatile web development agency specializing in custom application development, content management systems, and user experience design. Through partnerships with designers, agencies, and organizations, Fostermade is committed to building better digital experiences. Visit fostermade.co to learn more. This episode is also sponsored by Vector Media Group. Vector Media Group is a full-service interactive agency based in New York. They specialize in web and app design and development and online marketing. In addition to custom platforms, Vector is widely known as a top craft CMS and expression engine partner. Get in touch today at vectormediagroup.com.
Our guest, Lori Voss, has been a web developer for 21 years and currently finds himself COO of NPM Inc., which he co-founded. Lori cares passionately about the web and believes that everyone should be able to participate in making it better. He joins us today to talk about the rise of frameworks, component architectures, graceful degradation, and other trends in web development. Welcome to the show, Lori.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So Lori, can you tell our listeners a bit more about yourself?
Well, I grew up in Trinidad and Tobago in the Caribbean, and that sort of flavored my experience of web development and technology ever since. I sort of approach all of my career as remembering what it was like when internet access was very hard to get and computers were very hard to get.
So if you grew up in that area and internet access was very difficult, how did you get started working on the web?
I think it was Christmas of 1996. My mom bought a modem after me begging and begging and begging. And I dialed up to a local ISP and, you know, we were measuring our download speeds in like bytes per second at the time. Like, you know, loading a web page is like you'd click a link and you'd wait 5 minutes for this thing to show up. But I remember being incredibly struck by the fact that like websites that Trinidadians had put together looked exactly as professional back in 1996 as the New York Times. Like HTML only had so many features. There was no CSS. There was no JavaScript. So you could learn all of web development, like all that there was to know in an afternoon, and you could make something that looked exactly as good as the New York Times could make also in an afternoon. And that was really a breakthrough moment for me. It was, there's no barrier here. This internet, it's got no, you know, the fact that I'm very, very far away on a rock in the middle of the ocean, that's not a problem anymore.
That's cool. It reminds me of the first time I wrote my very first line of HTML and I was like, oh, wow, you can publish something instantly. It's kind of magical, a very new way of thinking.
Absolutely.
So today we're going to be talking about web development trends. Before we dive into some specific ones, Lori, I'm curious, how do you define a trend in web development?
Well, you told us that we would be talking about trends, and so I started thinking about it a little bit, and I think the metric that I settled on was growth. It's not about popularity, and it's not about any other metric. It's about something that is getting very big very fast, like something that, you know, it'll show up with, you know, thought leaders talking about this thing, and like there will be conferences about it and tutorials and demos, and, you know, every podcast about it will be about it for 6 months, and that's how you tell something is a trend. But I think the thing about them is that they're often ahead of the curve. Like the trend is not the thing that everyone's doing. The thing that everyone is doing is the last trend. The trend is the thing that people are about to do.
Right. That makes sense. So let's take, if you don't mind, because this is putting you on the spot. We didn't send this to you in advance, but I'm curious. When Ethan Marcotte coined the term responsive web design, would you have considered that a trend at the time?
When was that?
Oh, was that about 5 years ago or so? I think that's about the time frame. When it sort of took off, was it a trend? Would that be how you would describe a trend?
I would say the first time I heard the term responsive to refer to a web page was probably around 2012. Mm. So, yeah, 5 years is about right. And yeah, I would say that was definitely a trend at the time. But of course, like a lot of trends, it's, you know, gone from being a trend to just being a best practice. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't build a website that's not responsive anymore. At least I hope you wouldn't.
So trends aren't fly by night necessarily. They can become established practices.
Yeah, and the best ones do.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. So let's talk about some of those trends. This first one, this is probably one of my more favorite topics these days, frameworks. So it seems like there's like a framework for just about every aspect of building a website, designing, developing, everything, really. What do you think are the benefits of frameworks today?
I think that people think of frameworks as having some kind of technical advantage. Certainly the frameworks market themselves that way. And there are sometimes, you know, there are sometimes limited technical advantages to using one framework over another. But I think the real advantage to a framework is that there is a framework. Instead of building something bespoke, instead of building a snowflake of an architecture that nobody understands but you, you're building something that somebody else has put together. So it's something that somebody else has presumably used to build something bigger than, you know, your starter project. So they've run into edge cases and they've run into complicated things before you have. So if you follow the rules of the framework that were laid down to avoid that, you should be able to grow faster while hitting fewer roadblocks. Mm-hmm. And the other advantage of a framework is that other people are using this thing, right? So you can reuse stuff that other people have written. You know, you can read blog posts about it. You can answer, you can, you know, ask Stack Overflow questions about it. Because other people are using it, it becomes more useful. Mm-hmm. So when I hear, you know, when I go to a startup and people say that they wrote their own framework, like, no, that's kind of a contradiction in terms. Like, it's not a framework unless lots of people are using it. Mm-hmm. If you're the only person using it, it's not a framework. It's just an architecture that you wrote.
Oh, I find it a really good distinction to make it the difference between internal and external architecture, as you mentioned. So are you suggesting that if moving forward, people should be using the term framework to suggest anyone can use it, not just an internal team?
I think the more people who use it, the more valuable a framework becomes. Mm-hmm. The more people are using it, the less time you have to spend explaining stuff. Like sort of the granddaddy of web frameworks, I think, is probably Rails. Rails revolutionized the web industry. And the thing about Rails is that it's not a very good framework. Like, it's kind of weird. And, you know, there's a bunch of monkey patching going on and it's not super easy to understand. But the thing about it was that they were like, do it this way. And suddenly there was this huge pool of people who knew how to build a Ruby on Rails application. Mm. So right. I remember back in, you know, 2003 or whenever, if you hired somebody to work at your company, the first 3 months that they were working there was you just explaining to them your architecture. Like, this is where we put our HTML. This is where the SQL goes. This is where our database calls are. And, like, you know, ramping up on that architecture was a slow and laborious process that you had to build into the hiring. And Rails completely changed that, because you could hire a Rails developer onto a Rails app and they could start on the first day. They'd be like, I know where everything is. Mm-hmm. What is it that you want mm-hmm. done? And so that's where I think the advantage of frameworks is. It's in the people. It's in the less time spent learning things.
Yeah, absolutely. I was here in Albuquerque. They just started a new program. They're like 10-week coding boot camps, full-time coding boot camps. And they have a full-stack developer program, or, you know, boot camp, however you want to call it. And they're focusing on using frameworks to teach. And the students are students who have no technical, I mean, they may have some technical background, but no coding background. They've come from other industries. So it's a way of kind of giving them a very quote unquote quick way to learn how to build something, you know, within that 10-week program. It also, to your point, Lori, some of the frameworks that they have incorporated into the curriculum are specifically because the city is working with this program and the city needs people with that framework knowledge. So for the exact reason that you explained, when someone's hired and, you know, it's onboarding, they already have that fundamental framework understanding.
Exactly.
So I wanted to take a little bit of a step back. You mentioned about frameworks being very technical. So it's clear that frameworks are development related, right? But do you think frameworks are better suited for development? How about design, like UI frameworks?
I think they have the same benefits there. I think if a lot of people have established that this is a way that you design things, then you can onboard a designer faster in the same way that you can onboard a developer faster. I think depending, you know, what kind of a design framework and how prescriptive it is, it can become a problem. So, you know, if everybody's code looks the same, that's an advantage because only the developers ever look at it. If everybody's website looks the same, that gets kind of dull. Bootstrap was really, really popular as a way of just getting things started for the CSS of a web project for a while. And there was definitely this period where you were like, oh God, it's another Bootstrap website. These things all look exactly the same. But on the other hand, you know, visual consistency is a benefit. Like, you know, people expect the thing in the top left is a logo that you can click and it'll take you home, right? Like those sorts of, you know, universal consistencies of design make everyone's experience of the web faster. So it's not a home run as it is, I think, with server-side frameworks, but there's definitely a place for them in design and everything else. Like, you know, what is Agile except, you know, like a framework for running your team?
Yeah, that's true.
Right.
Internally at Bright Umbrella, we have called it a framework, but now that I've, you know, heard your points, I think we would just call it our own custom architecture, because I am not a fan of frameworks personally for the kind of work that I do. And so we created our own essentially architecture set of rules for our front end development. I could even call it like a pattern library or something like that for our HTML and CMS patterns or CSS patterns that I use so that when we start a project, I can get the project up and running a lot faster, kind of leverage the benefits of a framework where you can get something started quicker, but have less of the challenges of frameworks, which kind of leads me to the question of what do you think the challenges of frameworks are, or some of the cons of relying on a framework?
I think the problem with a framework is when it begins to become too specific. If a framework has a lot of opinions, if it's decided that this is the way that you should build things, the chances that the decisions that they've made, the sort of space that they've mapped out for you fits your problem perfectly, gets smaller and smaller. So there was, I've forgotten the name of the startup a couple of years ago. They'd built this amazing, amazing web app that let you build an entire web app in a GUI in the web. So you could use, you know, you could use a web app to build another web app. And their demo was this amazing demo where you could put together basically like a Twitter clone in about 15 minutes. But the thing was, and the company failed for this reason, was that it was basically all you could build. It was too specific. It was too designed for one set of imagined use cases. And if you needed to do anything complicated, you need to break out of the framework. So sitting at NPM, we have an enormous amount of data about what frameworks people are, in fact, using. And so I went digging through our data today to dig those out and find out what they were. So the top five... And the top one by a long way is React, which is not really a framework, right? It's part of a framework, but it's not all of a framework. And I feel that's part of why it's so popular, is that it's not all of a framework. It's just solving one problem really, really well. And number two is jQuery, which jQuery is not a framework at all, right? Or, you know, we don't think of it as being a framework at all. And it's incredibly popular. It's not at all trendy. It's just massively, massively popular. Like jQuery is not even primarily installed via NPM. So if you include all the people who are bringing it in via script tags, it's probably still by far the most popular framework, if you want to call it that. Then there's Angular, then there's Backbone, then there's Ember, and then there's Vue. And I think that if you sort of look at that list and sort of go down the list, you'll see that they're going from less to more specific. The further down, the more specific it gets, the less popular the framework becomes. And I think that's because when it gets incredibly specific, it becomes harder to map your use case to it.
Absolutely. Yeah, that makes sense. It also kind of highlights another challenge of frameworks, I think, which is the frameworks that are so broad, they do not address the edge cases. And frankly, this is my concern more from an education, a new developer kind of perspective. If a new developer has, let's say, taught themselves Bootstrap, and then their client or employer has a need that Bootstrap can't meet, I have concerns that they can then solve those problems on their own without the framework support, that, you know, they still have the fundamental skills to solve design or development problems without mm-hmm. the kind of community brain power that put together the framework in the first place.
Mm-hmm. I think I probably take a different position on fundamentals to you, if only because after 21 years in the business, I'm not sure what people think of as being fundamental anymore. Mm-hmm. When I started web development, the first book that I ever bought to teach me web development, the very first thing that the book taught me was CGI. They were like, this is the CGI. This is the CGI protocol. This is how you write a piece of software that knows how to speak HTTP, because there were no frameworks. There was nothing. There was nothing that knew how to speak HTTP out right off the bat. And so it was like, you're going to be writing, you know, we assume that you're writing either Perl or C, because this is 1995 and PHP hasn't been developed yet and neither has JavaScript. And you're going to have to write from scratch a web server. Like, they did not assume the existence of Apache, far less mm-hmm. Nginx or any of the rest of them. And they were like, so these are the fundamentals. Here you go. And instead of teaching you HTML, the book taught you SGML, which most people don't even remember anymore. Mm-hmm. SGML was like this meta language that HTML is just one application of. And so when I hear people talking about, oh, you've got to get to the fundamentals of HTML, I'm like, no, HTML is a framework. All of computers are frameworks on top of frameworks on top of frameworks. Everything is an abstraction on top of another abstraction. And the stack is so big and so complicated that it's impossible for anybody to know every layer of the stack. The idea mm-hmm. that there's a full stack developer is a myth. Like, the stack has 45 levels. If you've got 10 of them, you're doing really well, but you're not a full stack developer. And nobody is. So if the very first thing somebody learns is how to build an app in React and Redux, and that's all that they know how to do, they're fine. They can build, you know, 95% of web apps. And if they need to do something complicated that that thing can't do, then they'll figure it out. They'll break out of the abstraction eventually. But I think I can't define what a fundamental is when it comes to web development, and therefore it probably isn't a real thing.
I have never thought of that way, but it really makes sense when you explain it that way. Even just conceptualizing HTML as a framework makes sense. Very interesting. So I don't want the whole episode to be about frameworks. So let's talk a little bit about some of those component architectures like React that you had mentioned. How do you see the difference between, let's say, React and a framework? What makes it different? Is it because it is more narrowly focused?
Yeah, absolutely. A framework is usually, or, you know, often a sort of soup to nuts idea. It's like, this is how you'll start, this is how you'll end, this is how all of the things that you need to do to put an application together will work inside of this framework. And React takes a very different view. React says, this is how you will lay out your HTML, this is how you will respond to events, and this is how your views will re-render themselves when data changes. But it has almost no opinions about anything else. It has no opinion whatsoever about routing, which is kind of crucial if you're building a web app of any complexity at all. The data layer, it has a sort of menu of things that you can use. You know, Redux is quite popular, but it's not running away with it by any means. And I think that's part of why React is so overwhelmingly popular, is it's a really good size of abstraction. It takes this one thing that's very easily moved into anything else, and it absolutely nails it. Like, people are using React both to do web apps and also desktop applications and also mobile applications. Mm-hmm. The same framework is running in all three. You know, on my desktop right now, there are applications running that are written in React as well as in my browser, and that is an amazing success as a framework goes. And it's because it was so constrained in what it chose to address.
So it feels like we've been talking a lot about the pros, and even though Emily asked about the cons about particular frameworks, not sure we really dove as deep as it could have gone. Because, for example, you mentioned Rails is pretty awful. So wouldn't that be a con? Like, in regards to, well, now that there's these massive adoption of these things, and yes, people can go from soup to nuts to this, why would you say that, well, this particular framework is awful? Or what is awful about certain frameworks?
First off, I don't want to bash Rails. I wouldn't say that it's awful. I would just say that we've built things since then that are better. The challenges for framework are, if you pick the wrong one, then you end up in this very small pool of people, right? The advantage of a framework is that if everybody's using it, all of the problems are solved for you by other people. If you've picked the wrong one, if you've picked one that's declining in popularity, then you're going to end up with a pool of people who are less and less able to help you solve your problem.
Mm.
And you're married to this framework now because you've written everything in this framework, and you'd have to get out of it. You'd have to do a rewrite. But, you know, if you'd not used a framework, if you'd just written entirely your own thing, that would also be the case, right? The pool of people who'd be able to help you is one. Yeah. It's just yourself. So there are, you know, some frameworks are better than others, but I think in general, if you pick a pattern and you share it with other people, that's a universal good. It's never going to be the situation where doing it entirely yourself from scratch is going to be better than, you know, picking something that at least one other person uses.
To continue a little bit on the discussion about, you know, challenges or cons, and this is more specifically to like a front-end framework like a Bootstrap or something like that. You know, I find it challenging. I guess it's perhaps this is too much of a reflection on my desire to be a control freak, but you know, I don't always care for the way that someone else decided a pattern should be written or how that HTML should be structured. So, I mean, that's why I choose not to work with frameworks, but we inherit projects that another developer started with, say, Bootstrap. And one of the challenges we found is this one site we inherited that was built with Bootstrap in 2011. It's so tightly coupled to whatever was available at that time to try and uncouple it and do new things becomes a very time consuming, kind of a rabbit hole challenge with this particular site. And so it increased costs for the client as well in terms of we can't scrap it. We have to work with it, but it almost doubles our time for certain projects. So that's one challenge. But then the converse, not converse, but another side of it is I was watching a thread on Twitter. I think it was yesterday. It might have been this weekend. But people were kind of talking about frameworks and why some people choose them, some people don't. And, you know, one person's comment is one that I relate to myself. Sarah Sweden was tweeting that she would rather write her own from scratch than try and fix what someone else built in a framework. For example, like if there's some sort of accessibility needs that weren't addressed by, say, the framework, then retrofitting it to get it to work to meet some sort of accessibility compliance would be more challenging than writing from scratch. And, you know, I think that's a relevant scenario. I think it's one of those things that it's kind of before you dive into development, you need to really think about those sorts of things before you decide you're going to rely on a framework or some sort of library.
Yeah, I think one of the ways that one can sort of go down the wrong path using a framework is you can adopt it when what you're doing is too simple to really require it. Like people are longtime web developers spent, you know, 10 years rolling their eyes at people who were, you know, using jQuery to put together a single page form that had one email capture box on it. And like, why is jQuery on this website? This form has one box and one submit button. What is the JavaScript for? And that can often be the case. You know, like if you're putting together a single page, relatively static marketing site, why are you doing this in React? You don't have components. You're using each one of these boxes exactly once. What is the reusability? What is this for? So yeah, just reflexively jumping into a framework because it's the only way you know how to throw something together can backfire sometimes. But if you're talking about, you know, stuff like accessibility and things like that, if the framework you're using isn't accessible, pick a framework that is, or improve the framework, right? Because then you don't just get it on that project, you get it on every project after that. And, you know, most of the people who put together these frameworks, they're pretty receptive to that kind of stuff. They're like, yes, we realize that that was one of the things that we haven't built yet is, you know, ARIA compatibility for all of this stuff. And how do we do that? And you give them the tools and they'll run with it, I think.
Oh, I love that suggestion. So do you feel that component libraries or architectures share the same pros and cons of frameworks, or do you think that maybe they're more beneficial because they're a little more focused for needs?
I think it's important to draw a distinction between what kind of components we're talking about. Obviously, NPM is a gigantic registry of 500,000 reusable components. And so, you know, just the sheer number of users there, we have like 8.5 million users now. Like, that's a fairly successful component model, one has to say, right? Not every single thing in there is getting reused, but lots of those things are getting used millions and millions of times a day. That's a component model that works. Turning JavaScript into modules that can be exported. I don't think anyone would argue against that on the front end, however, reusable components, they've been the holy grail for a long time, right? Like the closest we got for a while, I think, was jQuery plugins where you'd be like, ah, thank God someone has written this calendar widget for me and I can just drop it in there. But, you know, I still half the time it would look gross and the CSS would interact badly with your CSS, or, you know, it would do something strange and you wouldn't be able to change it. And React is the closest I've seen to genuinely reusable component architecture on the front end. And that, I think, is why React is absolutely running away with it. Like I said, we sit at NPM and we can see people uploading and downloading React components on the registry. It is where a lot of our growth is coming from. It is an enormously prolific and popular ecosystem, growing much, much faster than any other ecosystem in web development right now. And it's because it looks like somebody may have finally, you know, cracked the code of how to do reusable front-end components. And part of it is the way that they did that. They just broke all the rules. They're like, the HTML is in there, but it's not HTML. It's JavaScript. And the JavaScript's right next to it. And the CSS is in there, too. And the CSS is also JavaScript. And everyone is like, what is this? This is such a... This is breaking all of the rules. Our beautiful, you know, separation of concerns, our, you know, 15 years of received wisdom in web development completely thrown out of the window by React. And the result is something much, much better than web development had come up with in the past 15 years. So, yeah, completely on board with component architectures. I think they work well, and I think React in particular is tremendously exciting. It solves a problem I've never seen solved properly before.
With this new problem being solved, what do you see happening? Do you see anything new, more innovation coming from what React has introduced, the sort of breaking the rules mentality? What else might come from it?
That's a really excellent question. Because what you're saying is, what is the thing that we weren't doing because we were constantly redeveloping our UI, right? Like if you were putting together a web app and you say you were building it on top of Rails or one of the other backend frameworks, you were still 5 years ago starting from scratch with a blank sheet of paper for your CSS and your HTML and, you know, working out what it was going to look like. And if you've got reusable components, what is it that you can do? I think the answer is probably more complicated web apps than we've ever seen. I think we'll be able to spend more time building features and less time getting the individual behavior of one component to work right. And I think that's part of why it's turning up in desktop application design, right? Because web applications, simplicity is kind of a virtue. You want it to work well on a phone. Phones don't have a lot of space for buttons and UX and stuff like that. But, you know, desktop applications are desktop applications. You can cram every button in there that you want. And the fact that you can use a technology that was built for the web to build desktop things is interesting. So I think it will mean that probably in the medium term that mobile development, you know, mobile app development, desktop app development, and web development begin to move closer together. Mm-hmm. I think that's already beginning to happen, and I think that trend is probably going to continue.
Well, one thing that is a little bit concerning in regards to all this, I mean, this sounds super great, like it sounds very advanced, but our listener, Christopher Kennedy, specifically wanted you to be on our show to get your opinion on graceful degradation. So we're talking about all these fancy features and things like that that often needs to have every bell and whistle in terms of your browser and JavaScript and all that fun stuff. So what is your opinion on graceful degradation? Is that even a trend itself too?
I don't know that graceful degradation is, if graceful degradation is a trend, it was a trend that was trendy 10 years ago and then lost favor and then sort of came back. I wrote a blog post about this, I don't know, about a year ago, maybe 2 years ago now, after seeing a bunch of very, very good web developers get into a huge Twitter fight about this. There's basically two things that people think of as graceful degradation. There's what web apps do, which is sort of the offline first movement. Like, we will load your entire web app, and then if you lose connection, everything still works. And when your connection comes back, all the actions that you've been taking, they sync up to the server in the background. The thing that's degrading there is the network connection. And for a web app, that works fine because you get exactly one chance to load a web app. And then it sits in your browser, it sits on your phone until you're done using it. So, but, you know, and if you're using an app for an hour, the chances of you losing internet connectivity in that hour, especially if you're on a mobile device, is quite high. So being able to withstand that kind of degradation, that makes a lot of sense. One of the problems of that is that it means that you have to preload a bunch of stuff, and that makes it slower to load in the first place. And that's where the other set of people begin to yell, because if you think about a website, if you're used to be using what I would call a flat website, like a media website, the New York Times or something like that, people don't load, you know, an article on the New York Times and then use it for an hour. Mm-hmm. They load it. Mm-hmm. They need it to load as fast as they possibly can. And also they'll do it dozens of times a session, right? If you're reading lots of articles. So instead of this one chance to fail to load, you have lots and lots and lots of chances to fail to load. And the network is still flaky. So the chances of one of those things failing is much higher. So that's when you get to progressive rendering, which is the other kind of graceful degradation. The idea that you don't need all of the pieces of your website to load to be able to, for your user to be able to do something useful. You want to like load the HTML as fast as possible, render it as fast as possible, then get the styles in there, then get the JavaScript in there. And if your connection is interrupted at any point in that 1 second process, you've still got something that works. Mm-hmm. If what you've got is a web app, that's never going to work, right? If Gmail has only 50% of Gmail loaded, Gmail is useless and there's nothing you can do about that. But if a New York Times article loads only the text and not the images, 90% of the utility of that article is still there. So I think people sort of get into a fight about graceful degradation because there's two of them and mm-hmm. you have to tailor what use case you're optimizing for.
Yeah, I think that's a really good distinction, particularly now that we're dealing so much, the conversation's just so much different today than it was 10 years ago when I think it was a bit of a trend to talk about progressive enhancement or graceful degradation. But when you are talking about apps, it's a completely different discussion. And I think it's important to make that distinction. I am curious, though, are these topics within the web development world, are they popular topics? Is it something that you see other developers, you know, struggling to define or struggling to approach in an, you know, a user focused way?
That's an interesting question. I think those sorts of things are the topics that really high power web developers working at large corporations where you have big teams putting together complicated websites. They're the sort of things that they care about. That's also the sorts of people who talk about conferences, at conferences all the time. I think the average web developer is just trying to get something out of the door by Thursday, right? You know, they're not so interested in whether it works offline or whether it progressively renders, as long as it renders at all, because it needs to be out by Thursday. So there's a very long tail of developers, I think, to whom that kind of stuff, the time required to get that stuff right, will always be a luxury.
Yeah, I think that is frustrating because it is something that, you know, regardless of what you're building, you do want it to be accessible to whomever is trying to access it. And yet we are in this world of it's due Thursday.
Accessibility is its own driver. If enough people are doing something, best practices change to adapt to that thing. I think
yes.
The place where that's most obvious is the trend for mobile web access. Something like 3 or 4 years ago, 50%, Google flipped over to being 50% of all of its traffic is coming from mobile devices. That's a tremendous shift, right? Mm-hmm. In the 2000s, there was this brief period where everybody had giant screens and fast connections, and you could be absolutely positive that everyone had a lot of screen real estate to look at your web app, and they were running it on a fast enough computer that processor wasn't a problem. And it was all Shangri-La for about 10 minutes. And then in 2007, Apple introduced the iPhone, and suddenly everybody was browsing the web on tiny, tiny little screens that could barely run JavaScript on extremely limited processors. And it took a couple of years for people to realize that had completely changed the landscape. Now everyone is doing responsive web design because we have no idea how big our user's screen is anymore, not even to a vague approximation. And websites are just getting simpler because so many people access them on phones where there's just not a lot of room to cram in a lot of complicated stuff. So you begin to see weird things like hamburger menus on desktop websites. And I'm like, why is there a hamburger menu here? You have plenty of desktop real estate. And it's because very few people access that website on a desktop. Then most people access it on a phone, and a hamburger website makes sense there. And we had to get it out of the door by Thursday, so we didn't bother to come up with a desktop view for this primarily mobile website, and that is a really fundamental shift.
You know, I think that's good to point out. I think it'll be really fascinating to see how things continue to evolve in terms of what people are using and then how that in turn affects what our quote-unquote best practices are.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just looking up some stats this morning. 3 years ago, 5% of the traffic to NPM's website was from mobile devices, and this month it's 10%. 10% is not, you know, a huge amount, but like that's amazing when you consider there's almost nothing that you can do on our website that makes sense on a mobile device, right? Like, I suppose manage your teams and stuff like that from a website, but I can't imagine a lot of people are doing that. And I ask people around, you know, what is it you're doing on NPM's website on a phone? Because it's 1 in 10 of you. They've got to be doing something important. And it turns out that the use case is people who code primarily on a laptop where they've got limited screen real estate and they want to keep the documentation open for the for the module that they're reading. You've done this.
Yes.
I have done this.
Right. Yes. That's what it is. It's people reading the documentation on their phone while they're coding on a laptop, which I think is amazing. That's 10% of our, that's 10% of our views now.
I'm curious, how did you figure it out? Just asking people how they were using it. How did you figure out that it, that was the scenario?
Yeah, absolutely. I have the advantage of, I routinely give a talk at called Stuff Everybody Knows at various web incubators. I meet novice web developers in groups of 200 at a time on a fairly regular basis. And it's fascinating. It is amazing talking to people who've just got into the industry and hearing the things that they think of as fundamental and always true and the things that they think of as complicated and strange. You know, these are people who they grew up in React. And so they're like, well, obviously that's where you put the state and this thing is a prop and you do this other, you know, and like, you know, they're using ES6 features that I'm only just getting used to. And then you're like, oh, document.getElementById. And they're like, what's that? They're complicated. It's just like, you know, the things that they think of as being easy and the things that they think of as being hard are very different, which is why, again, when people talk about fundamentals, I'm like, 5 years from now, the people who grew up in React are going to be talking, complaining that people don't know the fundamentals of React because we've built some framework on top of React.
Oh, I love this. That must just give you the just an incredible perspective on the industry and where things are going, just to have that experience so often with new developers.
It's absolutely fantastic. So if anybody listening would like me to come and talk at their coding bootcamp, please invite me because I love doing it.
Well, you mentioned your Stuff Everybody Knows talk, and I was actually checking it out myself. And one of the points you bring up in the talk is about performance. And I'm just curious, it's become an increase, you know, you see it as a topic much, much more on digital magazines and blogs and Twitter and everything else. And of course, as mobile has become more important and Google's mobile first push, performance is also more important. And so I'm wondering if you feel like performance itself is a trend, or is it more, does it fall more in those sort of best practices slash foundational things?
Like I was saying, I think it's an adaptation to the new landscape that we found ourselves in. The primary device that people access the internet on is a phone now. And phones have, even in North America and Western Europe, phones are fairly limited devices. And as the number of people online grows, the percentage of people online who are accessing it on first world internet connections and latest model high-end devices get smaller and smaller as a percentage of all of the people who are accessing the internet. So performance is becoming more and more important because if you need to if you're going to address the 1 billion internet users in India, you need to understand that the way that they access the internet is very different from the way that we access the internet. You know, they access it for 5 minutes a day, they download everything, and then they, you know, play with it for a while. Facebook, I think, has done an amazing job of adapting to this new landscape. They sent teams of people to, you know, live in India for months at a time and use the internet as people in India use the internet. And they came back and said, we cannot use this app. This app is completely useless. We have to change it entirely. Like, Facebook Lite is a totally different experience because it was built with a totally different set of expectations. And it's doing really well for that reason.
So, I mean, in a way, then, I guess it sounds like performance is a trend in the sense that
it wasn't thought of as importantly as now.
Yeah, I mean, it's evolved. You know, like you said, it's an adaptation. And in many ways, trends sort of reflect that, pushing the boundary, pushing the curve, responding to something new that we didn't expect.
Yeah, the trend is mobile web access, and performance is the reaction to that trend rather than the trend in and of itself.
Good distinction, yeah. Okay, so we've been talking a lot about all these particular technologies that developers can use, but we haven't discussed why someone should use them and how to evaluate. So what do you feel, what are the factors developers and development teams should consider when evaluating a trend to implement, like let's say React, or whether to learn it?
It's really tricky because it's hard to tell off the bat. the way to tell a trend is really going to work for you is if everybody's already doing it. Like React, so many people are using it, it's really not going to go anywhere. A really great example is MongoDB. MongoDB 7 years ago was like the trendiest of databases. And I remember taking a look at MongoDB and its like actual performance characteristics and its, you know, its failure modes and stuff like that, and just like absolutely table flipping and being like, I'm never using this database. This database is a clown shoes database. I'm never going to do anything with this. And this week, MongoDB filed for an IPO. And I was like, what? Like the joke database has filed for an IPO? And I went looking into their website and I went digging into their performance characteristics and their failure modes, and they've fixed all of those problems. They've had 7 years. They just got critical momentum and critical mass and enough money that they could throw enough people at this problem to fix every problem that they had. And it works, right? They're going to go IPO. They've actually solved a lot of problems for a lot of people. So, you know, to some degree, it doesn't really matter how good or bad the trend is, as long as everybody's on board, you know, enough people will show up and fix whatever problems exist. But at the beginning, it's impossible to tell, right? You couldn't tell 7 years ago that MongoDB was going to be big enough to go IPO. That's certainly not what I would have bet. So if you're picking a framework that's just getting started, a thing that not and a lot of people are using, you just have to go with, does this make my life easier or not? You know, do I like it? You know, does it make me feel comfortable as a developer?
You know, and I think another question you could ask, this was presented to us on Twitter by our listener and a former guest, Ben Furphy. Does it solve a need or a problem? If not, then don't use it.
Exactly.
And I think that makes perfect sense, especially, like you said, in the beginning, when there's really kind of no way of knowing what the future holds. But you can know if you have a problem, that whether it's going to solve it or not.
Exactly.
So when I introduced you at the start of the episode, Lori, I mentioned that you think everyone should participate in making the web a better place. I'm wondering, is this idea of making the web a better place, this sort of soft skill, is that something that should be a trend in our industry?
I think what I'm talking about when I'm talking about making the web better for everyone is making it possible for everyone to participate in making the web better. I'm making the web, and by making the web better, I usually just mean making the web bigger. Like, think back to what I was talking about in the first days. I said, you know, it was 1996, and this 16-year-old on a rock in the middle of the ocean was looking at the internet and going, I can publish a web page today, and exactly as many people can see it as can see the New York Times. I'm going to do that. In fact, I'm going to do that for the rest of my life. I remember making a very clear decision, you know, which is it's 21 years ago now that I made that decision and I don't regret it. So I think the thing that I would encourage, if I could encourage anything, is welcoming people on board. Anything that makes web development more accessible to developers, anything that makes it easier to write web apps, simpler to write web apps, faster to write web apps, anything that encourages people to participate who are currently being discouraged from participating, anything that makes more people get involved in making the web better, I'm on board. So that encompasses everything. That's like, stop looking down at people who are using web frameworks. Stop looking down at people who are using the language you don't like. Just stop looking down at people in general, right? Like, don't, you know, our industry is rife with people who, with stories of people who are, you know, prejudging other people on the basis of gender or race or economic background or language or whatever. And we should just cut it out. That's the thing that I want to stop doing, and just saying, you know, let everybody just build web pages. And the ones that are good web pages, other people will visit. And the ones that are bad pages, web pages, other people will not. And that's really the only metric that matters.
Yeah, I like that. And I think that that's something that I do wish to see that be a trend. Maybe trend's not the right word, but a popular topic in our industry. Even myself, you know, I started in this field about 20 years ago as well. And especially when I got into the web standards movement, it was, that was the only way to build, and anything else was unacceptable. And it was just so rigid, my worldview. And as I've obviously matured and gotten older and worked with more people and taught more people, you get softer about your views and you see more reasons for why there are always exceptions to every rule. And I think that is something that I think is as important to talk about as, you know, our mentality and how we think of our work and other people executing that work is just important to talk about as the technology we're using. Like you said, looking down on people for using frameworks, I have been guilty of that. And it's more about questioning, does it work for you? If it works for you, then understanding why it works for that person and maybe being open to how their view might influence me to not be so narrowly focused. That's something I personally would love to see us have a greater focus on in the tech industry in terms of embracing the people part of it.
I completely agree.
Right. And I mean, this just reminds me of something Lori said earlier in the show, you know, in regards to frameworks where someone could reach the end of the utility of that framework, but that doesn't necessarily mean that person stops learning.
Mm-hmm.
If they had the idea to learn the framework in the first place, they have the, right, you know, the same brain to learn what else is out there, mm-hmm, to fix whatever problem that framework has stopped fixing.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Exactly.
So Lori, is this idea of making the web a better place, a bigger place for people to participate, is that something that inspired you to start the LGBTQ.technology Slack?
That's it's sort of become my hobby, is starting online community spaces for queer people. It's funny because I keep doing it. Like, this is the latest one, but I've done it like 4 or 5 times before with extremely varying degrees of success. I can't say that I have some, like, you know, some gigantic thesis going on with that one. In general, like, getting more people involved is great, but often it's just an experiment. Like, lots of the time, I just wanted to try out a new web framework, so I built a new forum website using this new web framework, and because I couldn't think of anything else, I made it like gaygeeks.org, which I ran for a long time, and, you know, people showed up, and it became like a clubhouse for some very small group of people. Yeah, I can't say that I had some grand thesis. I'm really, really gratified by the response to it, though. There's something like 3,000 people in there now from all over the place. And,
wow,
you know, people have told me, you know, I've got jobs from this, I've found friends from this. Like, it's made me feel less alone in the world. Like, it's awesome. I can't say that was what I was intending. Although, in fact, you know, early on in the life of it, a bunch of people sort of sat me down and said, that thing that you were expecting this thing to be, it's not that. It's going to become this other thing instead. And the smartest thing that I've ever done with that community is go, you're right. What you think it is better than what I thought it was going to be. Mm. You should run with it. So I barely do anything with it anymore. It's run by a very, very selfless group of volunteer admins. And really all that I do is make sure that Slack doesn't shut us down every so often.
Just for our listeners who might be interested, can you describe the community a little bit?
So it's just a Slack community. I assume most people are familiar with Slack at this point, that welcomes queer people of any description who are involved in tech in any way. And it prioritizes the safety and comfort of marginalized groups over most other things. And that is an interesting choice to base a community around. So there's lots and lots and lots of channels, hundreds of channels for people to talk about all sorts of things. And it avoids the sort of normal failure modes of a community space where you get, you know, if you get 3,000 people in a room, there's absolutely no way that a fight isn't going to break out. So each channel has only, you know, a couple dozen people in it. And as a result, those dozen people get along fine. And everybody's sort of in the meta community and they can, you know, they can bounce around. But everyone's not forced to bump into a bunch of people who have wildly different assumptions and life experiences to them. And that sort of works pretty well.
So Lori, do you have any final advice when it comes to getting on the dev trend wagon?
The only advice that I would have is don't wait too long to get onto the trend. If it's happening, it's happening and you should get on it. Otherwise you're going to be left behind. But also don't wait too long to get off again. Like, there's nothing lasts forever. That's what 21 years of web development has taught me. Like, you know, when I started, we thought everybody was going to be writing, you know, enterprise websites in Java using object-oriented paradigms forever. And we were completely wrong. And then everything seemed to be PHP, and we were completely wrong. And everything was going to be, I don't know, you know, everything was going to be Rails for a little while. And it was like, no, that turns out that's wrong too. So right now, React, definitely the trend to get on board. But, you know, that train's going to come to a stop sometime, and you'll have to remember to get off again.
Excellent. Good stuff.
So that's all the time we have for today. But before we finish up, we've got our rapid fire 10 questions so our listeners can get to know you a bit better.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yep.
Okay, first question. Introvert or extrovert?
Introvert.
The power is going to be out for the next week. What food from the fridge do you eat first?
I'll drink all of the milk.
What's your favorite website for fun?
Twitter.
What's the last thing you read?
Last thing I read was a biography of Alexander Hamilton.
What's the best piece of professional advice you've received?
Wow. Assume you're the smartest person in the room until somebody proves otherwise.
How about the worst piece of professional advice?
Go into enterprise Java. It's the future.
What's your favorite color?
Sky blue.
If you could take us to one restaurant in your town, where would we go?
Mission Chinese food.
Mm. What's your favorite board game?
Probably Monopoly. It's a boring choice.
Not boring, classic.
There you go.
Last question. Hulu or Netflix?
Netflix.
All right. So that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining the show, Lori.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a blast.
In case our listeners want to follow up with you, where can they find you online?
By far the best place to reach me is on Twitter, where I am Seldo, S-E-L-D-O.
Thanks again, Lori. I really love this conversation. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks again.
Control Click is produced by Bright Umbrella, a web services agency obsessed with happy clients. Today's podcast would not be possible without the support of this episode's sponsor. Many thanks to FosterMaid and Vector Media Group.
We'd also like to thank our hosting partner, Arcus Tech.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about Control Click, make sure you follow us on Twitter at Control Clickcast or visit our website, controlclickcast.com. And if you like this episode, please give us a review on Stitcher or iTunes or both. Links are in our show notes and on our site.
Don't forget to tune in to our next episode when we celebrate 100 episodes of Control Click Cast. Be sure to check out controlclickcast.com/schedule for more upcoming topics.
This is Leia Alcantara
and Emily Lewis
signing off for Control Click Cast. See you next time.
Cheers.